If I bleed tonight, if I am sad tonight, I don't have a job to find. And if I work tonight, if I'm so tired tonight, I'll fall asleep when I'm home. When I'm Hey everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Power Slam podcast here on Inside the Ropes. My name is Kenny McIntosh, joined as always by Finn Martin. Finn, the sun is shining in Glasgow. It was supposed to be rainy, so it's caught me off guard. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm good. Yeah, it's warm here in Lancaster. I mean, we had some pretty amazing thunder and lightning last night, just after midnight. Did you have that in Glasgow?
We did have a little bit of thunder and lightning yesterday, yeah, but not too much. The weird thing was today was supposed to be we're recording this like 3:30 in the afternoon. Between now and 7 o'clock was supposed to be thunder and lightning, rain, but no. So it's supposed to be sunny now through at 7 o'clock. So the weather just has no idea what it's doing, just like the governments.
Well, that's right. And some would say just like Finlay and Kenny.
Some would. Some uneducated people would say that. it's good to be back. There's loads of wrestling news as always, lots of stuff going on, and I thought we could maybe split it up a wee bit, or shake it up a wee bit this week, and maybe talk about SmackDown first, because
yes.
I tell you this, Finn, I find it my least favorite wrestling show to watch is SmackDown. It's just devoid of life.
Devoid.
There's nothing there. It's that there's all these people, and like Sheamus is a babyface now. Shorty G's a heel, but he's still Shorty G. Matt Riddle already just feels like another guy. Miz and Morrison are diabolical. They are atrocious. I just find that the Raw stuff, I'm far more excited to talk about that than SmackDown. But am I out on my own here in a boat of bitterness? Like, what do you think? Has SmackDown been delivered in the last few weeks on the road to SummerSlam since the horror show Extreme Rules?
Well, not really. I'm with you, Kenny. I mean, it was a Sheamus show, wasn't it, on Friday, August 7th episode. I mean, if you're a fan of Sheamus, you probably enjoyed this past Friday's episode of SmackDown.
But even if you're a fan of Sheamus, I mean, Sheamus has essentially been calling Jeff Hardy a junkie for the last month, and now he's all of a sudden, you know, coming out to aid Matt Riddle. In wrestling, I think turns sometimes come out of a really kind of nice, natural thing that happens. And this just felt like they ran out of ideas for Sheamus as a heel, so let's just turn him babyface.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it wasn't obvious that it was a babyface turn. I mean, he came out to attack King Corbin, who earlier in the show had sent Shorty G out to collect the King's ransom by interfering in his match with Matt Riddle. So that was more of a revenge thing, not necessarily a babyface act, but we'll get to that in a moment when we go through it. But I am with you, yeah. I mean, it just feels like the whole show has been diluted. It just, nothing really feels like it's got any potency at all. And like Jeff Hardy, we were just talking about the Jeff Hardy-Sheamus feud. I mean, they had this long-running feud. Jeff Hardy won it. And like, if you were to look back at Friday's SmackDown, it seems like Sheamus won that feud because he's all over the program. He was the one who was presented as a star and received more screen time than anyone else. Jeff Hardy was absolutely an afterthought on Friday's episode of SmackDown. So it is very strange the way it's being put together at the moment. It doesn't feel like they're trying to make anyone special. It's as if they're trying to bring everyone down to a certain level so we don't have any stars who could become a problem. Apart from, as I say, Sheamus. He was just all over this show, and I've no idea why. He's kind of acting like a heel, then he's attacking another heel or confronting King Corbin, then attacking King Corbin, but is not really behaving like a babyface as he's doing it. But, you know, maybe this is step one of his pathway to becoming a babyface. But that's going to be a tough sell because, you know, the Jeff Hardy feud is so fresh in mind and he was so vile in that feud that it's going to be very difficult to really, you know, warm to him again. I think it's going to take a while anyway.
Yeah, very, very strange. So because we opened the show with a Firefly Funhouse, which we'll get to in a minute. But we opened the show with Matt Riddle versus Sheamus, which, you know, was the initial part of it. And then in the end, Shorty G appeared. He attacked Riddle. Riddle wins by DQ. And then in the post match, that's when we end up seeing Sheamus giving Shorty G the brogue kick. Yeah. He's angry at him for kind of costing him the match, but we obviously know Shorty G turned heel the previous week on Matt Riddle. So it feels like we're in the kind of midst of double turns, but it all just felt very murky. And, you know, Matt Riddle just doesn't seem to me, if you bring Matt Riddle in July, by the time we get to SummerSlam, Matt Riddle should be, doesn't need to be in a main event match, but he should be in a match where he is very clearly on the ascent. And he seems to be the afterthought of a story involving Sheamus and Shorty G.
Yeah.
And King Corbin.
And King Corbin, you're right. Matt Riddle is the one of that foursome who should be the star, presented as the person that we immediately think of when we think of those four people or those matches or scenarios in which Riddle's involved. And instead, he kind of feels like number four on the list instead of number one. I thought Sheamus and Matt Riddle had a very physical match. I mean, I found the match, you know, very entertaining. I mean, Sheamus is a really good in-ring performer still. And I think Matt Riddle's tremendous. You know, Riddle kicked out a White Noise. You know, at no point did he look like he was going to lose. Then Shorty G ran in, attacks Riddle for the DQ. Obviously, Sheamus is disqualified. Sheamus responded by flattening Shorty G at ringside. Sorry, Riddle ended up attacking Shorty G at ringside. And then afterwards, Sheamus blasted Shorty G with the bro kick. So, I mean, it was kind of a bad night for Shorty G, wasn't it, Kenny? In that he runs in, gets beaten down by Matt Riddle and by Sheamus.
So he's just turned heel and already he's a geek within a week.
I mean, he took an absolute pasting from Riddle at ringside. And then I think Sheamus actually hit him with two broad kicks. I think that's correct. I think
he did hit him with two. He did
hit him with two broad kicks. Sheamus was sweating like crazy, wasn't he, at the end of the match? Do you know that? My God, he was sweating. You'd have thought he'd acclimatized after more than a decade living in Florida, wouldn't you? And then, you know, backstage afterwards, Sheamus warned Corbin not to have anyone interfere in his matches again. And they had some fighting talk, and then that led to what happened later on in the program. But yeah, this was very much felt like Sheamus. He was the focus of this whole thing, which was bizarre.
It's just, it doesn't really make any sense. And then, unfortunately, I mean, Miz and Morrison, like, you know, we talk about this more than Sondra does. You know, look, people should be able to watch wrestling and not be embarrassed by it. But like, like anybody I know, if they walked in and saw this Miz and Morrison stuff, they'd be like, "Why are you watching this?" Like, what? And you know, Morrison is a guy who went away. Went to Lucha Underground as Johnny Mundo and did all this. Went to Impact as Johnny Impact, did all this cool stuff, and he's come back and he's just. I mean, has the return done anything for him? Doesn't really. I mean, he seems to be an advert of, you know, the it used to be that, you know, like Drew got fired and Drew went away and upped his game and changed his stuff and came back and now he's reaping the rewards. John Morrison went away. Did a lot of good stuff. He's come back and he's in this team with The Miz where, you know, they're trying to be this kind of cheesy chicken shit heel team, and because they do the talk show segment, they're kind of involved in everybody else's angles, but they tend to bring everybody down a little bit rather than putting the angles over, like we saw here with the Sonya and Mandy stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Morrison did well when he returned, and Morrison and Miz felt like a serious act when they reformed their tag team. I think Morrison returned in, I think it was January, I think that's correct, and then they reformed their tag team. I thought they came across as a real serious unit. Where it all started going wrong for me, for Miz and Morrison, was the Braun Strowman feud, where in a handicap scenario, they were presented as inferior to Braun, and then Braun destroyed them. That was when was that? Was that Extreme Rules? Was that Extreme Rules? No, it wasn't.
It was the one before Extreme Rules, Backlash.
Backlash, my God. I mean, this is where we're at right now. I mean, there was a time where, you know, I can remember what happened on pay-per-views 30 years ago, and I'm struggling to remember what happened on a pay-per-view 2 months back.
I'm going to ask, when we do our first podcast in November, my first question to you is going to be, can you tell me if I'm the full card from Payback from August 30th? And you'll be like, what? There was a Payback on August 30th? Because we'll have forgotten by then.
Well, exactly. So, yeah, it was the June pay-per-view. It was the Backlash pay-per-view where Morrison and Miz were. And it was all, the whole setup for that match was just comedic. And, you know, they were there targeting Braun's classic car. And, I mean, the whole thing was just a joke. At no point were we ever led to believe that Morrison or Miz might beat Braun Strowman, and of course neither did. And I think they've really been floundering ever since then. They've been like this comedy joke act. And here they are again on SmackDown, living down to expectations. You know, an episode of the Dirt Sheet, they had, it was Mandy Rose's hair. She of course had a haircut by Sonya Deville on SmackDown the previous week. So there was a blonde wig with goggly eyes, and they were there pretending that it was Mandy Rose being interviewed, and they were doing a making out like voices for her and trying to be funny. And then Sonya Deville joined them. It did improve once Sonya turned up, I've got to say. The segment did improve once she arrived.
Once Sonya arrived, you kind of wished that Miz and Morrison were no longer there. Was the problem, because once it got to Sonya and Mandy, you know, we're more into the Sonya and Mandy story. Yeah. So, you know, when Sonya's talking, we're back in. You know, we're like, okay, we enjoy this story. But they just, you know, their whole act just really feels...
I mean, it's so opening match, isn't it? It's just like an opening match. It's like Santino Marella level.
I saw Miz doing a media interview. And look, there's nobody better at media interviews than The Miz, but he did a thing saying if he doesn't get to main event WrestleMania 37, then he'll be retiring. Well, you better fucking start looking at homes in Palm Beach, pal, because at this rate, you'll be lucky to not be in the kickoff show.
Well, exactly. I mean it's like, he's not going to be main eventing anything.
He's not going to main event the kickoff.
So Sonya turned up, and it was as if she resented the fact that she, with her feud with Mandy Rose, which has been presented as serious, and her attack the previous week on Mandy, where she cut her hair off, smeared makeup all over her face and everything, that was presented as, you know, a serious, you know, full-on beatdown, you know, total humiliation of Mandy. There was no, you know, wink, wink, ha, 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 that's funny. That was a serious business. So here she is. She's been inserted into the Dirt Sheet, which is this clown show, and she's got to try and preserve the heat that she's managed to build the previous week in her attack on Mandy. So it was the whole thing just, you know, the Dirt Sheet was not conducive to the story or the messages that Sonya was trying to get across, which was Sonya versus Mandy is a serious piece of business. Whereas and the Dirt Sheet are now just, you know, comedy act.
And the Dirt Sheet used to be a WWE.com exclusive thing where they would do their comedy over there and it was fine. But now to bring it as a talk show segment like Miz TV, it just didn't work. I mean, but, you know, it did end up giving us the main event of Heavy Machinery and Miz and Morrison. But, you know, the real story in that was when Mandy, you know, ran out to brawl with Sonya and the match gets called off. And this is one thing I will say that's starting to bug me in that WWE are doing, is that matches are getting called off for no reason. And it's starting, you know, we had the Asuka and... Sasha, not the Asuka and Sasha match. What was the match where it was Asuka and Sasha where what was the match where Asuka ran out and hit Bayley in the outside, and then a match in the ring was just called off?
On last week's SmackDown, wasn't it? Was that Asuka versus Sasha? I believe it was.
Asuka Sasha, and then there was a match recently where somebody came out and attacked Bayley on the outside, and nothing happened to the competitors. No, it was Shayna Baszler ran it, I'm sure, on Raw. I've had a brain fart. I don't know what the match is, but you know what I mean. Somebody came out, attacked somebody on the outside who wasn't involved in the match, and then the match was over. No explanation of what happened. similar story here. So, you know, Sonya's not in the match. So when Mandy comes out, it's not like they've you know, taken out the competitors in the match. It's a brawl between the two of them, but again, it gets called off. And I mean, I did enjoy the brawl, and Sonya and Mandy get some good heat to the program, but it just feels, I don't like the idea that matches are just sort of stopped because stuff's going on the outside, because that's never been the case.
Well, at least not since Vince Russo left.
Yeah, at least since he left.
You used to have those finished matches with no finishes on a regular basis in 1999, didn't you?
I tried to forget about them. I'm now in the year 2000, the Chris Kresge era, where things make more sense.
Exactly. But yeah, the point is right. We're now in 2020, 21 years removed from the Vince Russo era in WWF. And yeah, the rules are supposed to make sense. And yeah, it's pro wrestling. You're always allowed to use a little bit of creative license. But I think once you start deviating too far away from, you know, the law and order of what regulates and governs pro wrestling, it all stops making sense. And the result of that is audience apathy, which you are experiencing right now, Kenny.
In bucket loads.
Exactly. Right, and that's what happened, because you just think, well, oh, they're not really playing by the rules. Oh, well, if they don't care, why should I? And that is your reaction. That's the last reaction you want to provoke from someone who watches your show, especially when you're struggling to keep your ratings up, when you're struggling to maintain your numbers. You want the opposite response, so more people will watch and encourage people who've stopped watching to watch again. So, but yeah, it was, I mean, you know, Sonya was there on the dirt sheet. I thought she did a really good job. You know, I want to make Mandy, you know, look as ugly on the outside as I know she's on the inside. You know, they all buried Mandy, then Heavy Machinery came out, then that led to the main event. Sonya's at ringside, as you say. Mandy ran out with a new hairstyle, which
I looks Corey great.
Corey Graves referred to as a soccer mom hairstyle, which obviously will mean much more to our American listeners than our UK listeners. I'm really sure if that's a phrase that anyone uses in the UK, is it, Kenny?
No, but I think AJ Styles made people very much aware of what it was when he was called a soccer mom with his hairstyle back in 2016.
Was that our old friend John Cena?
That was Big John, Big Match John.
Oh, I miss him so much.
But I thought Mandy looked great, and I hope that we get Mandy versus Sonya at SummerSlam. I think that I wouldn't have said that before this week, but I thought that they brought the fire to it. I kind of wanted to see everybody else go away and just see them fight it out.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think they need a big blow-off match, and not on the pre-show, not on the kickoff. Give these two a match with a, you know, street fight or whatever. These two have absolutely gone for it. You know, they have. You know, Mandy there, she sacrificed her hair, she sacrificed her looks. Remember that the other week when she was, well, she's going back probably more like 4 or 5 weeks ago, when she was thrown into the ring steps, probably more than that, she was thrown into ring steps, got a massive great bruise on her thigh. I mean, she's proven that she's game. You know, she's going to go out there and she will put 100% into it. You know, she will absolutely go for it out there. So I think if they give those two like 10, 12 minutes on the SummerSlam show, give them a stipulation, false count anywhere, whatever, something like that, where they can, you know, really like, go for it and really put something together more than a regular match on SmackDown. There's got to be a stip attached to it, because we've already seen regular matches between Sonya and Mandy at least twice, maybe three times on TV. So there's got to be something attached to it that's going to distinguish it from their TV matches, surely. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, is it going to be hair versus hair? Is that where we're leading? I mean, Maybe that's something they do. It would be a big stipulation. Next week is we've got what, two SmackDowns left this week and next Friday's. I think a stipulation match is probably wise, given we've seen them in so many concoctions so far. But yeah. I think that this big blow off should be a stipulation.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think hair versus hair. I mean, Mandy's already given up enough of the hair, and really, I don't really like to see that stipulation in America. I mean, I know it means. It's a huge, huge deal in Mexico, but it doesn't really mean that much in America and in Western wrestling, US or UK wrestling generally, I don't think. And I think it's, you know, a lot to ask of someone to. I mean, remember when Molly Holly had was it WrestleMania 20, I think it was, wasn't it, where she had the hair versus hair match?
Yeah, WrestleMania 20, her and Victoria.
And they kind of cut away before she did even finish shaving her head. And it was just like, you know, I don't think it's more of a joke stipulation. I think we need something serious, you know, as befits this feud. And I think these two have really proven that they can go and that they're credible performers. I mean, Sonya was a credible performer anyway, but we've said this many times, she's absolutely stepped it up on the mic. She's somebody who I think can be relied upon to carry 50% or more of any feud that she may have in future. And I think Mandy has really shown that she wants to be taken seriously as a wrestler, and she's not just going to get by on her looks. So I think all credit to her for that. And I think they should be rewarded with a proper, 12, 13 minute match at SummerSlam that receives some, proper promotion, some proper publicity.
We should mention that we didn't see, and I don't want to say Miz and Morrison are partially responsible, but we didn't see Naomi on the show, and we obviously saw her her being in the dirt sheet the other week. We saw the match with Lacey Evans, but she was not on this show, Finn, and there wasn't really a lot of online furore that there had been a few weeks before. Do you have any clues to why?
Well, I may have. Funny you should mention that. I mean, she faced Lacey Evans on the July 31st episode of SmackDown. And I just thought the match was yet another utterly forgettable, with one exception. That is a badly blown spot. I think it was supposed to be some type of sunset flip powerbomb to the floor. It was such a mess that Michael Cole said, "What the heck was that?" He didn't know how to call the move they did. It was a move Naomi did on Lacey Evans on the outside, and it was an absolute mess. Naomi scored the pin in the match. It was short and utterly forgettable, with the exception of that one blown spot. And it just felt to me again like, right, here we go, Naomi. Here you go. Show us what you've got. Prove to us that you are worthy of the investment of time, emotion, energy, thought, imagination, everything else. Go out there and have a match with Lacey Evans that gets people talking for all the right reasons, and instead it got people talking for all the wrong reasons. So yeah, no Naomi on this week's SmackDown. Doesn't bode well for her having a spot at SummerSlam, I would say.
And unless she's able to win the Battle Royal that we're getting this Friday to determine who Bayley's going to face at SummerSlam for the title.
Yeah, I mean, once again, she showed me nothing, no evidence that she deserves more than they've given her so far. And it's up to her. She's been there 10 years. And
she's got a big hill to climb.
Yeah,
to
I mean, standards obviously improved massively in that decade. You know, right now the bar has been set pretty high for the women. I mean, we saw on Raw this week, I mean, Bayley and Asuka had another really good match. We'll talk about that later. And the bar has been set. This is what people expect from female performers now. So, you know, it's up to her. If she can't, you know, reach that standard, then she can't really expect that amount of TV time to be allocated to her.
It would, the other big story on SmackDown, and it also happened in Raw, so I thought we could just kind of combine the conversation about it. And it's the conversation about Retribution, the black hooded gang who at the end of SmackDown, as Mandy and Sonya were sort of, you know, fighting, lights go out, they appear in black hoods, they chase off Cole and Graves, they've got pipes and bats, they're chasing off cameramen, the only camera angles left are outside the plexiglass, they're going into the crowd and laying out the spectator wrestlers, they get in the ring, they're screaming that this is their place now. Now, the SmackDown one I thought was okay. I thought it was fine. I think the problem for me is that they're dressed very similar to Akira Tozawa's ninjas.
Yes.
And they're all very short.
Yeah.
So that's a problem. But when I was watching Raw, I've not laughed this much in a long time. So I'm watching Raw and I'm enjoying the show. And all of a sudden, it looked like these children had shown up at the front of the WWE Performance Center. It took three or four of them to carry this like cinder block.
Yeah.
So they're not working out at the Performance Center, clearly. And and then they so to set this up on SmackDown, they have infiltrated the building, they're beating up wrestlers, they're tearing up equipment, they've got the ability to flicker the lights, they've got the ability to change production, but they think the next thing they want to do is carry a cinder block together and throw it through the reception door of the performance center. Then they all start screaming, "Yeah, this is ours, control, yeah!" And all I could think of was like a Ricky Gervais voice going, "Ooh, you're hard, aren't you?" Like, it was so pathetic.
Yeah, I mean, what a contrast between, as you say, between what they did on SmackDown, where they ran in at the end, they got like a baseball bat, a crowbar, one of them even has a chainsaw, which they use to cut through the ropes. They're spray painting some type of logo, I think it was, or graffiti in any way, the SmackDown logo on the ring apron, the perspex, the ring steps. What a mess. The ring canvas, the ring mat. I mean, what a mess they made. Chased off Michael Cole and Corey Graves, who like ran for their lives. I thought they did a good job selling the terror aspect, that they were genuinely fearful for their lives. So
they did. I mean, if they knew what they were capable of Monday on Raw, they ran faster. Four of them can at one time carry a cinder block to the reception area.
So, I mean, it kind of reminded me, I suppose, a little bit of like NWO. You know,
SmackDown felt quite Nexus-y. Raw felt like Primary 2.
Yeah, it was just, but I was trying to think, what's the point of all this? You know, why are you called, I mean, we now know they're called Retribution. I mean, how do we know this? We didn't know this the previous week. Has this been stated on social media?
It was on social media. But they also were kind enough to contact WWE to let them know that they were a new faction.
Okay.
Who were going to be trying to take over.
Well, I mean, to me, I mean, the announcer said it's Retribution. You know, what are they doing? It's like, well, maybe it wouldn't have been a bad idea to have an interview with them, or they could have sent a video in. But, you know, maybe then it would start looking a little bit like Aces and Eights from TNA. I mean, Aces and Eights to me was a bit of a flop. But, I mean, they were certainly more terrifying than this lot, this rabble. So, I mean, it's just like...
And they're all, like, look, I'm not a size person who's like, you know, this guy's too small, he can't make it. But, like, if your whole act is going to be that you are all hooded individuals who are trying to look menacing...
Yeah.
Could we not have one person who's at least 6 foot tall? One?
Well, exactly. I mean, you remember the massive ninja who's since disappeared? Maybe they could have recruited him.
Yeah, I feel like he's now in Raw Underground, but there you go.
Maybe he's the fella that's manning the door.
It could be him. Yeah, it could be the guy who's manning the door.
He's pretty damn massive, that fella, isn't he?
But I feel like, you know, what they did on SmackDown, you know, look, I'm not sold on Retribution because, to me, when they reveal themselves and all of a sudden they're a lot taller than the people they have doing it now, I assume, when they reveal themselves, there's going to have to be what do they want Retribution for? Who are these people? And
I've been thinking about this, and my theory is this. Perhaps the team is comprised of Eric Young, EC3, Paul Heyman, Vince Russo, and Jim Cornette.
What a squad. What an absolute squad. Can you imagine? I'd watch that. I would watch. Can you imagine Jim Cornette, Paul Heyman, EC3, Vince Russo, and Eric Young? My God.
Yeah. I mean, Heyman, Russo, and Cornette. I don't know, there's three people in wrestling who you know, dislike each other more. So quite an assembly. But I mean, yeah, I mean, and also like when they were on Raw and then they were there with this breeze block, that's what a UK name for a cinder block. Wasn't there like some little security guard who's like, "Hey, what are you doing? Hey, clear off. Here, hop it. Here you, get going." You know, and then they like chug cinder block through the door like, "Yeah, we'll go now." They're like a bunch of little kids. I mean, it was just absolutely comical.
It was so bad. But the thing is, I don't have any faith that whoever Retribution are, there's going to be an actual good reason for what they're doing, who they are, what's going on. You know, because with Nexus, if you even look at Nexus as an example, Nexus was quite an easy story. You've got these young developmental guys who are all kind of having the piss taken out of them, having to do this game show shit. And they come together and they decide to take over the WWF. They're gonna take over, be the new top guys. They make an impact. They take out John Cena. You know, it was quite a straightforward, good angle and good story. But with Retribution, I don't buy it. But the Raw thing did. I was cackling at the. Oh, it was so bad. Oh, let's just put a wee cinder block through the front door. That will show them, even though we already have access to production and we've already massacred half the crew.
Yeah. We've proven on the previous Friday, 3 days ago, that we can infiltrate SmackDown and do whatever we want. But by the following Monday, all we could do is chuck a brick through the window. I mean, it's just pathetic, isn't it? And on the Friday, one of them was saying, oh, we run things now. And he sounded like he was about 19. I mean, he just sounded like a little kid. So it's just like, I'm now trying to work out if they're going to last longer or less time than the ninjas. You know, that's the real question for me when it comes to Retribution. Will they be around in 4 or 5 weeks? Or will they last longer than Raw Underground? I don't know.
I think they will last longer than Raw Underground.
Possibly. I don't think any of these factions or concepts are going to be around by the time Survivor Series dawns on us. Retribution. To me, it's just like, why not send the videos in? Why not tell us who you are? Why not tell we're Retribution and we've got a score to settle with somebody or people?
And you should You could tie in that they were the hacker.
Yeah, exactly. That was another story that was just dropped with no conclusion. So you could mention that. And so at least that's serving a purpose. And that's what people like doing fantasy booking. It's like, oh, where's this going to go? You know, I always felt shortchanged, obviously, by the Nexus and the way everything happened at SummerSlam that year, 2010. We don't need to go over that again. But I remember there was a video, I think it was for Survivor Series that year. It was for one of the pay-per-views. And they had a promo there from Wade Barrett. And he said words to the effect of, the Nexus is part of a much bigger story that you're all too stupid to understand. And we never got that bigger story. And I remember feeling really shortchanged by that. So maybe actually, Kenny, I'm backtracking now. Maybe it's probably for the best that they don't do any videos because they will end up fulfilling whatever promises or threats that they make. So that, if actually, don't bother.
Okay, yeah, just don't bother. Well, listen, we've got so much more stuff to talk about. I do want to bring up to you, we should mention very quickly, the death of Kamala, James Harris, who passed away on a Sunday night, I think it was, from complications. He was on dialysis for his diabetes, obviously lost both his legs in the last kind of 15 years. And he apparently died due to COVID-related. He caught COVID when he went to get dialysis. He was 70. Kamala is somebody who's got, people I think sometimes think of him as just a kind of jokey heel in the 90s, but he was drawing houses with Hogan in the 80s. He was drawing with the Von Erichs. So he was a big deal at one point.
Yeah, he was. I mean, I think he made his debut about 78. Was known as Sugar Bear Harris and the Mississippi Mauler. He worked for CWA and other sort of southern places. Also, did some stuff over in the UK as well. Came over here and wrestled on the old British circuit. Was reinvented as Kamala, the Ugandan Giant, in 1982. That was in the CWA, which was the Memphis territory. And he had a big run there. Then went to Mid-South, did very well for himself there, went to World Class, also joined WWF. And as you say, had a really big run there with Hogan, playing a sort of character that, the problem, I think, for Kamala was it was a character that did not age well. I mean, in the cartoonish mid-80s, this sort of character sold, obviously, because he drew money and had success in more than one promotion. But by the time the sort of late 80s and certainly in the 1990s when he came back for that run and famously faced The Undertaker at SummerSlam 1992, I think wrestling had moved on a bit. And I just don't really feel like he was effective at that point. And when he was wrestling for WCW, came in, I think it was 94 after Hogan. And to me, it was just like, this guy just feels like so passe and, wrestling's moved on and characters like this don't really work anymore. But absolutely, he had a great run in the 80s, did well for himself there. Yeah, what an awful end to his life, as you say, due to diabetes, lost both his legs. I think it'd been really tough for him for many years. Passed away this weekend, age 70, of COVID-19. So, yeah, real shame. The whole end of his life just sounded really difficult, really tough, Kenny, really rough.
And I mean, something lighthearted that I wanted, because Kamala was one of my favorites when I thought he was just a really fun character. I always loved the whole, like, you know, he would try and pin the guy backwards and all that kind of stuff. And the way he would sell at the coffin when he did the match with Undertaker. But there's one clip that I will watch once or twice a year because it just ends me. So Kamala's a heel in 1992. In WWF, and then he turns babyface and he goes up against Kim Chi, his former handler, and then Slick, who used to be the heel manager, becomes a babyface because he was now Reverend Slick.
Yeah.
And on the Invasion of the Body Slammers VHS that WWF did, they would always, on a lot of the Coliseum videos, they would do those, like, you know, Gene Okerlund in the jungle with the Bushwhackers or something, and it'd be, you know, the kind of, you know, the thing that would throw to each match was a continuation of whatever this story would be for the video. And the Invasion of the Body Slammers one was Lord Alfred Hayes at a bowling alley for Slick trying to teach Kamala how to do 10-pin bowling.
Right.
And it's great because the whole time Kamala can't do it, he's just kind of confused, whatever. And then right at the end, when Slick and Lord Alfred Hayes are chatting off camera, you hear a strike. And it was Kamala, and he'd finally got it. And throughout the whole video, he plays it so well. He's so funny in the role. I mean, you are right, it could not be played today. You couldn't do somebody from Uganda who would be a savage in 2020. I mean, I can't even imagine what would happen if you tried to do that. But I think to a lot of people, he was a fun character, and people have a fond memory of him.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, apparently he was very well liked in the business, very well regarded, supposed to be a really nice guy. I think he ended up becoming like a truck driver after wrestling. I think he pretty much retired after the WCW thing. Maybe did a little bit there with USWA, but wrestling wasn't working for him anymore, mostly because he was aging, and also this character, there wasn't really a desire for it anymore, a market or an audience for it anymore, as the business changed in the 90s. It was very much you're kind of like a lot of the characters from that era. I always remember, I think when I first started watching WWF, I think he was teaming up with Seeker. And like, I remember just being kind of astounded by these characters. What's going on here? And I've got to say, they absolutely they were 100% committed to playing these characters that were like supposed to be savages. And I've got to say, by the standards of the time, it was in the cartoon era, that is, it was very convincing. Very hard to use that word convincing in connection with Kamala, but I mean, I thought they were really did, you know, there was no nod and a wink. It was absolute 100% commitment into this character. As you say, Kim Chi was his handler. He was often played by Steve Lombardi, as I recall. And, it was definitely a character that WWF did well out of, and babyfaces did well out of wrestling him. I don't think the matches were particularly grueling for the performers, for his opponents, because he didn't really do that much in the ring, did he? He did have the big splash, but he didn't really do that much, like chops and kicks. It was very basic style, and there was a lot of crowd interaction and crowd working. So I think it was probably quite an easy night wrestling Kamala. Probably didn't have to take that many bumps or absorb that much punishment. And fans back then absolutely did lap it up. There's no doubt about it.
I'm sure there was one of the years where, and I think it was like 2008, 2009, where, you know, when ROH would run every WrestleMania weekend, that Kamala came out as like a mystery opponent for somebody. And I don't think he wrestled the match. I think it was like a kind of a, you know, it was an angle more than anything else. But apparently people went berserk because Kamala had come out in like 2009. There was also a great segment he did with the Raw Diva Search in 2004, which is, the great thing about that segment, you can find it on YouTube, Kamala, the Raw Diva Search, is that you can tell that most of the women had no idea who he was. And the challenge for the women was to flirt with Kamala if you want a laugh. Honestly, it is incredible. Because Kamala will not break character at all. Yeah. And then these very attractive women are trying to be like, well, you know, that I love your face, I love your paint there in your chest. And he's just doing the noises and he's not selling for them whatsoever. So, you know, he in his later years, he was they always tried to bring him back and stuff. And I'm sure he did a match with Randy Orton at one point on SmackDown, and he was a legend killer as well. So he was always back doing stuff. So
that's right. Yeah, August 2005 had a match with Randy Orton.
But really sad.
I mean, certainly by the end of that, it was like a nostalgia. So it's a nostalgia kick. I mean, if you go back earlier, like for instance, when he became part of Kevin Sullivan's Dungeon of Doom in WCW, we were supposed to take him seriously as a monster heel. And by 1995, that was impossible to do. WCW, when Hogan came in, you had a lot of performers who came in with him, who pushed out of the way, a lot of the established performers, a lot of ex-WWF guys. And that was not well received by WCW fans at the time. But certainly in later years, he became a nostalgia act, you know, and that was reminding people of their childhoods. I mean, he was part of the gimmick battle royal, wasn't it? WrestleMania 17.
Yeah, he was, yeah.
So, I mean, and that was such an entertaining match for all the wrong reasons, you know, and that ticked the nostalgia box. So yeah, as a nostalgia performer, yeah, it was a barrel of laughs because it was just something on, you know, the undercard that was designed to provoke a smile. But as a serious performer, certainly by the mid-90s, he couldn't really pull that off anymore. But
there wasn't a lot of African-American guys who headlined the Garden with Hogan, and he did do that at one point, I think 86, I think it was, that he had his run with Hogan.
I think 86 would have been the time he had the run with Hogan, yeah.
So, really sad, but lots of stuff funny and serious if you go further back on the network that you can check Kamala stuff out. A couple of weeks ago you did say, Finn, that you wanted to say something nice about AEW. Last week they actually, on the August the 5th shows, AEW doing 901,000 viewers to NXT 753,000. So since Great American Bash, they seem to be back on track of winning the weeks and winning the demos. Do you think NXT is gonna, you know, be doing more kind of big shows like Great American Bash type theme things to try and be competing with things? Should we read anything into them almost getting to 1 million on this one? What do you think?
I think those themed shows definitely do work. They work for NXT as well. The whole Great American Bash thing was a hit for them, wasn't it? They did like a two-week run, didn't they, with the Great American Bash theme, and they did well in the numbers there. Same with AEW. It obviously does work because it's as if they're giving away, you know, a pay-per-view on free TV. So, I mean, it definitely does focus the mind. It's like, oh, it's not just a normal episode of Dynamite. You know, it's Fight for the Fallen or whatever. So, I mean, yeah, I think that's something they definitely will do, if not monthly, like every 6-7 weeks, I would have thought. I've been catching up on my AEW. I thought Eddie Kingston did really well on the July 22nd episode against Cody. Really beat Cody up in that match. I mean, that was like, to me, he was the first person they brought in who looked really angry and came across like a heel used to. I mean, there was quite a contrast between the way Eddie Kingston behaved and basically every other heel in that company. The July 22nd episode, that was a no DQ match. I didn't really feel like there was any need for them to use the drawing pins just before the end, the thumbtacks. I thought that was excessive, which is the case with many AEW matches, particularly with finishes. They always do too much. I could have done without thumbtacks, and that was something they could have used in a rematch on a pay-per-view or at a later date or on a big show. To me, it's like, well, why give that away in this match in which you've already done so much? I thought Kingston probably did tap out a little bit too quickly as well to the figure four leg lock, but prior to that, had sold the knee, so it was more believable. Yeah, I want to absolutely give huge credit to Eddie Kingston. Do we know if Eddie Kingston has been signed by
AEW? He has been signed. He's been signed off the back of that performance.
Right, rightly so. I mean, I've seen Kingston in Ring of Honor. I've seen him in NWA Power. I've seen him in TNA or Impact Wrestling. I've seen him in other promotions as well. And to me, he's a guy that there was things about, he always seemed to be something missing. And I often wondered if he had a bad attitude backstage, because he often wouldn't last very long in the territory in a promotion. But I'm glad he's been signed by AEW. I hope he's getting paid well. They made much of his, you know, his upbringing. The fact, did he say that he'd had to sell something to buy boots for this match? What was it that they said he had to sell?
Yeah, I can't remember what it was, but it was like he had to sell, like, what was he had to sell?
No, I can't remember what it was, but he'd had to, in order to get enough money together to buy boots for this match. It was probably a storyline, but I thought it was really effective, and it just showed this guy wants it. He's willing to make this sacrifice after 18 years in wrestling. He still wants it. He's still hungry. And I thought they did a tremendous job of conveying that message to the viewers, that here's a guy who's been in the business for nearly two decades, but still absolutely wants it and still got something to prove. And I thought that was the best performance I've seen from him in that match with Cody. I think MJF is doing well.
Do you think he's the right? Is he the right opponent for Moxley at All Out, which is now going to be the main event of that show?
I think that will be a test for Moxley. I still don't think MJF is the guy that a lot of people. I don't think he's as good as a lot of people think he is. A lot of people talk about him like he walks on water. He's not that guy yet. I think he's doing well and he's getting better, but I'm not convinced that he's main event ready yet. But I'm not saying that he won't be one day. But I mean, this is why John Moxley's there. He's champ. He's experienced. He's obviously really good in the ring. So this is up to Moxley to make MJF look like he deserves to be his challenger on that particular event. So we know MJF will do really well on the mic. He absolutely believes in himself because the company believes in him, and he's got the audience believing that, as I say, he walks on water. So he's doing really well there. As far as, yeah, in ring, I think there's still, I don't think he's quite put the jigsaw puzzle together, yet. But I think he will do. And I think this will be the night when Moxley shows what he's got. You know, can he make MJF look like that guy that people think he is? And hopefully Moxley can do that. So I enjoyed that. I think Orange Cassidy's doing really well for himself. I think the match with Jericho probably lasted too long, which is fairly typical of AEW. But I mean, he's doing really well right now. And I find it amazing that he's got this far without ever speaking. I don't think he's ever done a promo, has he?
Well, I mean, once you've watched the August 5th episode, he breaks his silence.
Oh, does he? I'm not up to that episode yet, Kenny. So, oh, does he speak on that one?
He does, because they have the debate. Because tomorrow's episode, August 12th, is going to be the rematch of Cassidy and Jericho. So they have a debate on the August 5th episode, which leads to that. There's a guest moderator. But even when they do it, the way that Cassidy speaks is very clever. It's very well done. And they've done the thing about waiting and waiting and waiting. So when he finally does speak, you get the pop, you get the moment. It's not something you just got on week two. So they've played the really good long game with him.
Yeah, I haven't got to that point yet. I must confess, obviously, because I wasn't aware that he spoke on that show. I think the Butcher and the Blade, I remember the first time I saw them in AEW, and in fact, the first few matches they had there, to me, they appeared to be in over their heads in AEW. And I think those guys have recognised what an opportunity this is and have become a really quite a competent tag team. In fact, proficient tag team. I think they've done really well. I mean, I know they're never going to be like stars or probably tag team champions, but as a team that puts other teams over, in matches of some length, not jobber matches or anything like that, I think they've done really well for themselves.
You need those kind of teams.
Pardon me?
You need those kind of teams who are not, you know, they might not be the champions, they're not jobber guys, but they're there to have matches where, you know, they are at least a name rather than just being, you know, FTR versus, you know, Steve Beck and John Silver or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And a team that's got the credibility, you know, to hang with a star team for 10 minutes or whatever in any type of stipulation match. And, you know, then lose in the end. And the star team has actually gained some more credibility from beating the Butcher and the Blade. Yeah, it's like, what happened? what do you get out of a match if you beat a couple of guys that don't mean anything? You don't get anything out of it. You beat guys who have got credibility, then you also go up in the credibility stakes. So I think they've done well. Can't really think of anything else off the top of my head, Kenny, that's...
I was going to ask you, because obviously, you know, we talk about the ratings quite a lot, and I think people like us kind of having that discussion. And with AEW having the 901,000 viewers last week on the August 5th episode to 753,000 with NXT, it feels like AEW are kind of the ones that, for the most part, are going to win the viewers.
Yeah.
And then you could have the odd time when NXT comes back. Do you think that we're now just kind of settling into that's the way that it is? Or do you think, are we going to get to a time before the end of 2020 where Triple H or Vince kind of go, that's it, we're stacking NXT now because we don't want to lose this anymore?
I don't know. I mean, I've no idea. I mean, I'm not sure how bothered they are about losing the ratings war with AEW each Wednesday, because if they were that bothered about it, I think they would be doing more to win each week. People have told me that, oh yeah, it drives them mad, but I'm not convinced of that, because by their actions, if they were that bothered, then they would do more to win.
But I mean, would the argument then not be that with the when AEW had announced Fyter Fest, in response WWE did the Great American Bash,
yeah,
and then they did the title switch, which actually, in hindsight, was just a hot shot, because
yes.
So I mean, it seems like in some ways they are bothered, but I guess it's how much are they bothered? How much do they want to choose this to be the hill to die on, of having to, you know, stack up NXT just to say that they're get higher numbers than AEW?
You know, I don't know. I don't think they're really that bothered about it. I mean, I think the thing with Keith Lee, you know, and Adam Cole, they wanted to put the title on Keith Lee. Obviously, now we know that Adam Cole is going to be having the match with Pat. What's the guy's surname?
Pat McAfee.
They did the angle on NXT last week, didn't they?
They did, yeah. He called him an little bitty short bitch.
I haven't watched that episode of NXT yet, if I'm honest.
I didn't know I'd spoiled that. But yeah, little bitty short bitch is what Pat McAfee called Adam Cole.
Oh, well, I'm not bothered about that. I mean, you know, from Adam Cole's appearance on his podcast, it was fairly obvious that it was going to lead to a match, and now we know that that's going to
happen. The angle was actually pretty good.
I've seen clips of it, and it does look really good. Triple H runs out, doesn't it?
Yeah, Triple H and Shawn are there. It's a pretty good angle. It's I think that, you know, for me, the thing that WWE can need to do, I know I've said this before more with Sandra, but NXT doesn't really know what it is as a show. You know, I think with AEW, whether people like AEW or they don't like it, they know what they are, or they know what they want to be. Whereas with NXT, it's like part of it is developmental, part of it is, you know, trying to be box office, part of it's other stuff, and it just doesn't really seem to flow as well as it did. And NXT used to be one of the shows that I would make it a point that I have to watch that show. And I've got to say, it doesn't feel as urgent. I think the best show that WWE are putting out right now, to me, is actually Raw.
Yeah, I mean, I think with NXT, I just don't think right now that can... I'm not saying it can't be helped, because they could certainly make NXT more focused. But at the end of the day, they are still a developmental brand. So that is their number one purpose, is to ready people for Raw and SmackDown. So that is always going to apply to some extent. You know, I mean, obviously we know Karrion Kross is just passing through, don't we? We know he's not there for keeps, and that probably in 3 or 4 months' time, he'll migrate to the main roster. So that's the thing with NXT, is that, and that's the reason, I think, partly why they're not that bothered about winning the numbers war each Wednesday night, because NXT, that is its purpose. It is to prepare talent, develop talent, make them into stars, familiarize them with the public, so that they can and get them ready for to do, you know, TV. So they now WWE does the TV and all the other things that they do, all those things that you have to learn in order to be a big time player in the WWE system. NXT prepares you for that on Wednesday nights. And then when the time comes, you are then moved on to Raw or SmackDown, and NXT starts again with the next project. So that's the way it's always going to be. With AEW, that's it. This is as far as you go.
Yeah, that's true.
This is your ceiling, is Dynamite or the pay-per-views.
Yeah.
So you know where you're at and you know where you're going. Whereas with NXT, it's always going to be in a partial state of flux, I feel. So
they could do with hiring like a transition consultant, because the majority of people who go from NXT where they're learning about everything to the main roster, it does not go well.
Well, you are right about that, yeah.
Which is a problem, but I think that's kind of, you know, I don't know whether some way to transition that Vince kind of gets a feel of who a character is or who they are before they come up, so that he is behind them and he wants to, you know, to do something with them. So hopefully they come up with that. But very quickly, I just wanted to ask you, though, obviously the news came out, there was a big shakeup at Time Warner this past week. And one of the Warner Media execs, Kevin Reilly, is gone. And he was actually the top supporter of AEW. He got them, he was the guy Tony Khan worked with to get the TV deal. They are signed through to the end of 2023. But do you think, is this departure anything to worry about? And do you remember when Jamie Kellner, which I guess is the big example that some people are bringing up, do you remember when he left, when he came into AOL Time Warner back in 2000, was it very apparent straight away that WCW were in trouble, or was that more of a shock?
I don't think anyone was really talking about Jamie Kellner until 2001, when he cancelled the TV so that WCW could not be sold to any company other than WWFE, as it was known at the time, parent company. So, I mean, I don't think I'd even heard of him prior to that. Maybe I had, but I mean, WCW had so many other problems to worry about that was just way down. That was way down the list. You know, no one was really worried about this guy in the office. I mean, WCW, even when it was doing really well, was not thought of, you know, it was not highly regarded by many people who worked in the TBS Time Warner empire. I mean, this has been well documented, I'm sure. You know, it was always this promotion that was kind of seen as, you know, a bit of an embarrassment to the organization, even when it was doing huge ratings and drawing huge profits. As far as what's going on now, I mean, the sign for another 3 years plus, as long as AEW continues to deliver the numbers, I think they're going to be all right. I mean, it was a completely different situation with WCW because it was owned and financed by Time Warner and was losing fantastic sums of money. So it's completely different. I don't think you can really draw comparisons between the two. And it's 3 years off before this contract ends. So who cares, really? You know, I mean, this guy, whoever's in there now, who's his replacement, could well have left by then. I mean, who knows what's going to happen in the next 3 years? But I don't think AEW has got anything to worry about. They've just got the TV slot, and it's not, you know, obviously they are paying for the production and there is money being spent on AEW, but it's not like WCW where they were assumed the financial burden of everything and it was, you know, losing tens of millions of dollars a year.
Yeah, Cody had put a response up on Twitter about, you know, saying there's nothing to worry about. We've had, you know, more viewers than they thought that we would have. We've got the extension. It's a great partnership. So I don't think there is anything to worry about. But I think we all want AEW to be around for the competition in wrestling, because that's what you want. So the idea that I think when there's any comparison being made by anybody to Jamie Kellner, people start to get a bit itchy. They start to get worried.
I mean, I just don't really see the connection. But I mean, you know, in this day and age, people will find a connection between anything if it's an opportunity to catastrophize. Well, you know, just, you know, social media, it's, you know, it's stock and trade. You know, it's fueled by people catastrophizing, isn't it?
That's what it's all about. Well, listen, let's move on to Raw. What did you think of Raw this week? Did it carry more urgency to it than SmackDown?
I think he did do, yeah. I mean, I think the start and the end were two very potent, very powerful angles, I felt. So the start and the end, I thought, really, really sold the show and were the most memorable aspects of it. I will say about Raw Underground is that, you know, it's supposed to be grubby, it's supposed to be gritty, but by week two, Kenny already feels ordinary.
Where are the women?
It's what?
Where are the women? They're gone.
Oh, yeah, they're gone. Well, some people complained about that on the social media. So WWE responded. You know, with that blatant sexism. Get those women out of here.
We did see Shayna Baszler on the Underground, which was good. I mean, it's wacky. It is wacky.
I mean, they did answer one question. I mean, we were talking last week, what happens when someone who's on Raw Underground then passes through the door to regular Raw? And Eric from the Viking Raiders was on a regular Raw this week after his commanding performance on Raw Underground last week. And he was playing regular, funny, jokey Eric from the Viking Raiders. So now we know that people play.
It makes no difference whatsoever.
There is a distinction between these two environments. And when you're on Raw Underground, you play this character. And when you're on regular Raw, you play this character. Thus, what is the point of Raw Underground?
Last week was obviously the shock factor of what it was. This week, the second week, was fine. I think, like you said, the issue is going to be when we have the big guy, I can never remember what they call him now, but Babatunde, you know, when he eventually leaves Raw Underground, is he going to be the same character? Is he going to be somebody different? How is Shane McMahon doing in this role as the host of Raw Underground?
Well, he's still enthusiastic about it. He's more enthusiastic about it than I am by week two. I'll give him that.
Did you manage to stop yourself from going on to Euroshop and purchasing one of the new Raw Underground t-shirts?
I was not even aware that they existed, Kenny.
Get one in black, get one in white. Whatever colour suits your mood, Finn. You could be walking down Lancashire, Raw Underground.
Buy them now before they're discontinued. That's what I say.
In a couple of
years from now, there'll be a hot item on eBay.
That's a good shout. Probably better to buy like 10 of them and keep them for a couple of years from now. Let's talk about the big opening to the show, which was the contract signing for Dominic Mysterio. Dominic Mysterio and Seth Rollins. Dominic had to sign the contract for the match at SummerSlam and the match to become the WWE superstar. Samoa Joe was presiding. Samoa Joe basically cut a promo for Dominic, and it kind of led to then Seth Rollins kind of beating Humberto Carrillo in very quick succession, and then post-match, Murphy and Seth Rollins kendo sticking the shit out of Dominic Mysterio in a very brutal way. Did you come out of this wanting to see Mysterio and Rollins?
Well, I think so, yeah. I mean, I think it was... I mean, there was the contract signing. I think part of the problem with this was it was moderated by Samoa Joe, the contract signing.
Mm-hmm.
So you were almost more interested in seeing Seth Rollins versus Samoa Joe than Seth Rollins versus Dominic Mysterio, certainly before the beatdown angle at the end. And it felt like it did more to promote that than Rollins versus Dom Mysterio. I thought Rollins showed more heart, more passion here for this character than he ever has previously. And in response to a question, I think it was from Samoa Joe about why did he change? Oh, actually, it wasn't. I think it was from Dominic Mysterio about why did he change? And Seth Rollins said, I tried to be Mr. Burn It Down. I tried to be Seth freaking Rollins. And guess what happened? I got crapped on by every single person here, as in fans and every single person watching at home. So he kind of blamed other people for this metamorphosis that he's undergone, you know, becoming the character that he now is. Dominic was saying, well, you know, and Rollins is trying to say, well, I'm fighting for the greater good. And Dominic's saying, well, no, you're not. You're actually fighting for yourself. You know, Dom just saying that he was going to kick Seth's ass at SummerSlam. Then Rollins said that there's no way that Dom would last, he wouldn't even last 10 seconds in a straight-up match with Seth Rollins. They made a point actually here of saying that Rollins is like the best wrestler of his generation. That was one thing they said, didn't they, Kenny? And that was something that was kind of feels like that's going to be the way they're going to present him from this point forward.
I don't agree with that, but sure, if that's, you know, you've got to have a gimmick, Finn, right? You've got to have something.
What would your gimmick be, Kenny?
Overrated, but I endure. That would be my.
Ah, fantastic. So Rollins says he's going to allow Dominic to use the Kendall stick, which he brought to the ring, or anything else in his toolbox. So that kind of did even the odds, I guess. Gave Dominic more a fighting chance for their match at SummerSlam. Then Rollins said, get out of the ring because I've got a match with Humberto Carrillo. He came out. Rollins, as you say, won that really by pinfall without exerting too much effort. And then after the match, you know, Rollins and Murphy had the big fight with Dominic. I thought Dominic really kind of put up a struggle here, but in the end, they sort of started nailing him. Rollins and Murphy started nailing him with the candlestick. Then they wrapped him up between the top and the middle rope and beat him down with multiple candlesticks. At one point, Rollins was whacking Dominic in the chest and Murphy was whacking Dominic in the back. So he was taking it from all sides. Meanwhile, Rollins is there staring into the TV camera and saying, you know, hi, Dad, you know, mocking Rey Mysterio, who we're told watching at home. And by the end of it, yeah, my God, Dom was macked up, wasn't he? He was macked up by that Kenny. What a beating he took.
It makes me want to see the match. And I do think it went on for too long. Because I think one of the arguments that I've heard bandied around, you can make the argument of, you know, Dominic Mysterio is in that position for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Nobody came out to do anything. You know, nobody. And I mean, that's similar to SmackDown with Retribution. Nobody from the back came out.
Exactly. I was going to add that before. I mean, Retribution are there. There's only five of them, I think. I think there's five of them. I mean, that's right. There was only
and they
five.
Don't look like you need a full five wrestlers to beat them up.
Exactly.
looks like if you send three, you've probably got a good chance.
Well, exactly. So, I mean, you know, you've got Retribution there running roughshod over the whole SmackDown and, like, threatening female trainees and all this awful, appalling behaviour. Like, why isn't the locker room emptying and running these people off? I mean, maybe that'll be next week. But you're right, Samoa Joe, who earlier, I mean, I know it's kind of difficult because if Samoa Joe made the save, again, the focus would then have been on Rollins versus Samoa Joe, which it felt like it was at the start of this angle. So I do understand that that would be tricky if Samoa Joe got involved, because the message here is it's supposed to be Rollins, Dominic Mysterio, not Rollins, Samoa Joe. But I still feel like something should have been done and someone should have broken this up earlier. I mean, I think Samoa Joe should have done. I mean, he should have just, you know, down the headset, left the table, and then maybe they could have had security at ringside. So just having like one little shot of Samoa Joe at ringside being restrained by security, or I don't know. But there was a way of doing it where Samoa Joe could look like he wanted to be Dominic Mysterio's savior without our focus lingering too much on a potential match between Joe and Rollins. I think there would have been a way of doing that.
Sound unreasonable. You know, it sounds like that's something you could absolutely have gotten. But I mean, I think that it was a good angle to get people wanting to see Dominic get his hands on Rollins. I don't know how you book the match. I mean, because in theory, Seth Rollins should be able to destroy him because Seth Rollins is the greatest wrestler of his generation.
His generation, that's right.
What a crock.
Mysterio, I mean, some of his body language and his expressions, he kind of looked a little bit worried when he was out there, and he should have looked meaner and tougher and somebody who was out for retribution. I think at points there, he sort of looked fearful of Rollins, and I kind of get why that would be the case, but he's hell-bent on vengeance, right? That's the message. I mean, we're supposed to believe that Seth Rollins put his dad's eye out, for God. In fact, both of his eyes, right?
Both of his eyes, yep.
Yeah.
He always, I mean, Dominic has a very baby face. That's one of the things that goes against him, is he just looks very, very young.
So, I mean, he should have been, you know, he should have been slavering and just going wild and trying to get to Rollins, you know, to exact vengeance for what Rollins did deliberately to his father and also to Aleister Black as well. Murphy, remember, did Aleister Black in and all these other terrible deeds that they've done. So I really felt like Mysterio should have brought more rage and anger to this segment. I think that was kind of lacking as well. But my God, yeah, he stood there and he took that beating. I mean, it, in a way, it's hard to really condone that. I mean, I'm all for heels getting heat on baby faces, and I think that's something that wrestling needs more of. And we need, obviously, loads more selling than we get to try and convey the message to the public that this really does hurt, you know, and really does matter. We don't get enough of that in really any promotion right now, at least any of the American promotions. So I don't know. I don't really want to contradict myself because, you know, I try not to do that. But I mean, there's something about that beating. I understand they've got to try and get heat, but it's pro wrestling and there's got to be a way of doing it without really doing someone in like that, really, you know, hurting someone like that. So yeah, it was kind of unsettling to watch. I didn't really like watching it, but I understand it was necessary to get the point across that Rollins really is a bad person, as if we didn't know that already, and will do absolutely anything. And the idea being that when Mysterio goes one-on-one with Rollins at SummerSlam, hopefully at that point, he is frothing with rage and can't wait to get at him. So, I mean, I guess so as that's the outcome at SummerSlam, all this will be worth it. But we need that from Dominic Mysterio at SummerSlam. When he comes out there, he's got to be hell-bent on vengeance and, you know, and needs to be cutting promos to that effect and to convey that message that I don't care what happens to me. You know, I'm going to take you down, even if, you know, no matter what happens to me, you're going down, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And now we're going to talk about a couple of other big things in the show. Before that, you insisted that we bring this up. I would have sneaked past this. But Mickie James makes her return to Raw. And within 6 seconds, she's interrupted by these two goons, Lana and Natalya. And then Lana laughs at Mickie James. They call her, Lana calls her, she calls her a boat.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
calls her a boat. Great. And then Mickie said, you know, I expected that from you, Lana, but Natalya, you know, you've got a legacy all of your own. You've worked so hard off your family's coattails. And the thing about boats is that they sink. So now, from that diabolical verbal exchange, Mickie James is facing, I assume, Natalya next week.
Well, hopefully.
Oh, I mean,
maybe it'll be Lana.
I mean, at least that'll be shorter. At least that will be. And the thing is, Mickie James had to put up these two, and they're in like matching outfits now.
I mean, that's why we haven't been on TV for a while. They've been getting measured up for these matching outfits.
Color coordination, Finn, it is key.
I mean, it's like, I don't know what era that pattern was from, but I mean, maybe they're setting a new trend here.
I mean, I feel like Natalya and Lana are now going to, maybe they're on the road to becoming women's tag team champions one day. The Iconics did it, so the bar is low.
Well, I mean, yeah, the bar is low. Yeah, I would say Lana and Natalya probably are at least as good as the Iconics, I think, on balance. But yeah, Lana and Natalya, they gatecrash James's mic time. I'd forgotten Mickie James was even still under contract. I thought they got rid of her back in April. Wrong about that. And Natalya said that she was the most winning woman in all of WWE history. And then she compared herself to Serena Williams. I mean, is that who you think of? Serena Williams, you know, obviously pretty good at tennis. I mean, Natalya, is she up there? Is she wrestling's answer to Serena Williams, Cam?
No, she is not. I mean, I've never in my life thought of Serena Williams and Natalya in the same sentence. It's just never, I've never made the correlation. Natalya is, yeah, I feel like the more years that Natalya wrestles, the more I feel like the idea that she's this great wrestler is overstated. Like, she's decent. She is decent, and she knows what she's doing. But my God. But you know what? Maybe Lana and Natalia will grow on me. Maybe the act will...
They're not going to, Kenny. They're just not going to. There's just no way.
I mean, look, you never know.
You know, this is a bit of fun. This is, you know, the card stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, you can get away with it. And the thing is, they are, I mean, you said it, they are at least as good as the Iconics in the ring. So by that measure, they could be women's tag team champions one day.
It's always possible.
But the serious women's action came later on when we had Asuka taking on Bayley, non-title. And if Asuka won, she got the Raw Women's title match with Sasha at SummerSlam. And Asuka did get the win, 15 minutes. Another tremendous match with these women. It is no surprise to me that Vince McMahon was apparently saying last week at a creative meeting that he loves the Bayley character. Bayley's firing all cylinders. Asuka's a great fiery babyface, fighting for the pride of her friend that they've run out of town. This was great. I really enjoyed it. What did you think?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I really enjoyed Bayley did this blinding sunset flip powerbomb into the corner. I mean, this was as good as Naomi versus Lacey Evans was bad. So she did this tremendous move. Then afterwards did the Kairi Sane walk the plank thing. So mocking Kairi, then Asuka's raging, you know, seeking justice for a friend. Plies the Asuka lock, gets the tap out win. I mean, I think what would be interesting here was I kind of felt like Bayley tapped out pretty quickly. So I would like to see on SmackDown this Friday a conversation stroke confrontation between Sasha and Bayley about how quickly Bayley tapped out. It's like, well, you know, you could have lasted longer in the Asuka lock. It seemed to me like you just gave up too quickly. You know, like you were thinking of yourself and not me.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, WWE can have that for free. You can have that booking idea for free.
You will not have an invoice from F. Martin on that one.
Because, I mean, I think they need to start cranking up. We need a little bit of tension again, I think, between Sasha and Bayley. They're getting on a little bit too well. So we need to, I think, crank that up a bit. So I think that would be a nice touch there. And then they could have a little bit of argument about whether or not Bayley tapped out too soon and she was thinking of herself and not her best friend. So, yeah, but really good match. I mean, it was no surprise at all that Asuka won. That was really inevitable that she would get the victory here so that she will then face Sasha at SummerSlam. You know, but there's nothing wrong with predictable booking so long as it makes sense, is there, Kenny?
Yeah, that's right. Predictable booking is absolutely fine. And you should do it. I think we're going to see at SummerSlam, by the time we record next week, we're going to know who Bayley's facing at SummerSlam as well. I think at SummerSlam, we're going to see something happen that comes out of it that furthers the story. And I'm looking forward to seeing what it is. It's my favourite storyline in WWE right now. So I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes.
Yeah, we've got a triple brand battle royal to determine Bayley's opponent.
So there will be people from NXT, Raw, and SmackDown. So, and then
that
the
takes place this Friday on SmackDown, doesn't it, Kevin?
This Friday, yeah. So we'll find out by next week who that's going to be. We had a match with Kevin Owens and Randy Orton, coming off what happened last week. It was a pretty good match. Went with 13 and a half minutes that Randy Orton won. Before we talk about the big story post-match, what did you think of the match with Orton and Owens?
Yeah, I thought it was decent. I didn't think it was as good as Asuka versus Bayley.
Owens doesn't really have anything to do right now, right? Owens is kind of floundering.
Kind of felt a bit unnecessary, really, and that then, you know, played into Orton's post-match promo, interestingly enough.
His post-match promo, he asked Ric Flair to stick around, and he basically told Flair that he used to look up to him, and now he doesn't even respect him anymore. He's no good. He should just cry. That's all he does now. You know, he doesn't want somebody who needs a pacemaker to stay alive or slipped into a coma. He's a whore for the spotlight. And then Flair cut this promo back to Orton, and it was just very impactful. And I didn't think Ric Flair had this in him, what he did here. And it all led to, in the end, you know, he's basically making the big sell to Orton of, you know, I'm not Ric Flair anymore, but I'm your biggest supporter, and I'm Charlotte's dad, and I want to be part of Randy Orton's life. And as they hug, the hug is a ruse. There's a low blow from Orton to Flair. The lights flicker. Orton goes for the punt. The light goes out. We come back on. We're meant to believe that Orton has punted Flair in the head. Drew McIntyre comes out for the save. He's shouting, "You son of a bitch." We've got people checking on Flair. And we go off there with McIntyre and Orton kind of staring at each other. And that's the sell for SummerSlam. What did you think of this segment as a whole? And talk about Flair's performance.
Yeah, I just would like to mention that Orton in the promo said that Ric Flair's ego was the catalyst for this match and that it was unnecessary for him to face Owens, which was my sentiments exactly as I was watching the match. So I thought that was really, really clever that played into it, that this match only took place because Ric Flair had arranged it, presumably without consulting Orton. Orton at first is saying that he couldn't be angry with Ric Flair because he helped him out when he was in a jam back in 2002. But then he, as Orton does, he changed tack and said that Orton said that Flair was like a liability. There was really quite a vicious blow at one point when Orton was saying that Ric saw Orton as a son to him, almost like the son he never had as a wrestler. So I thought that was pretty stiff, and I'm sure Flair was fine with it, but that was a pretty tough comment, I thought. Then he said that all Ric could do was cry. Now, I'm not sure at that point if Ric was supposed to be crying, and I think he was supposed to be crying, but actually wasn't. Not that that really harmed this segment in any way. Orton, as you said, accused Flair of being a junkie for the spotlight. You know, wasn't the guy that he used to be, and then Flair acknowledged that he wasn't and said that after he'd been in a coma, the first thing he did when he came around was that he wanted to ring everyone up that mattered to him, to tell each one of them how much they mattered to him and how his life changed completely 2 years ago. Wasn't that guy anymore, but really wanted to be by Orton's side, didn't want to overshadow him, wasn't all about making sure the spotlight was on himself anymore. He was there to facilitate Orton's next title win and the title win after that, referred to himself as just Charlotte's dad. So I thought it was a really humble performance by Flair. It felt very real. Certainly the realest point of the show, obviously the Kendall stick shots, Dominic's torso were very real as well, but this felt more real, if you know what I mean. And we kind of knew what was going to happen next, but I thought it was still very well timed and very well executed and just played out pretty much perfectly with Orton hugging Flair. And then when Flair's back's turned, he hits the low blow. So he's even got to nail Flair from behind. You know, he can't even do that to his face. And Flair's down on the canvas and the lights go out. And obviously they weren't going to allow Orton to deliver the punt, even a safe one, to Ric Flair. I'm not really sure if you can do that move safely. I think it's just far too dangerous. I think Christian did take the punt, didn't he?
He did take it, yeah. I think the thing is that there's just no good look to a 71-year-old guy that's been in a coma to give him, you know, to do that to. It would look really bad. So I think they got round it pretty cleverly given what's going on with Retribution.
Absolutely they did. But I mean, the thing about it is that I'm sure Flair, if he was up to it, would have taken it. You know, I mean,
I'm sure he wanted to. You know, when you're a performer, I'm imagining that, you know, in your mind, the show must go on. So
absolutely. I think Vince was about 70 when Kevin Owens did the famous headbutt. Mm-hmm. And he was. Might have even been 71 at that
point.
I think
he was 71, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, Vince would have taken it, but obviously he hasn't been through what Ric has. So, they handled it perfectly. So, you know, and I'm not suggesting for a moment that Flair should take any punishment. Absolutely, of course he shouldn't do. But I thought they really handled it very well, very respectful to Ric there and to Orton as well. So we got around the punt issue. And then, as you say, Drew McIntyre ran out, called Randy an evil son of a bitch and was just saying that he was going to hurt him at SummerSlam. And they were there glaring at each other. And we have the, you know, state-of-the-art WWE camera work's always perfect in these situations where you close up a Drew, close up a Randy, and they're all raging, and the show goes off the air. So, yeah, that's the message, that it's all about this match, and that's the main event of the show for sure. So, yeah, I thought it was really well done. I thought this was Flair's best performance in I don't know how long. It was certainly better than the performance with Batista back in February of last year, it would have been. When Batista beat him up, I thought this was handled a lot better. And I thought Flair was just seemed very real out there. There was no over-the-top theatrics or anything. It just felt like a very sort of realistic sort of segment, didn't it? Like you could believe everything that was said.
Yeah, it was a tremendous angle to set up the match at SummerSlam. It's maybe one of my favourite angles in WWE this year. I think it was great. It was just perfect.
I mean, it's almost going to be a tough act for Drew and Randy to follow that, isn't it?
Yeah, but it did give Drew an extra oomph of why he wants to go after Orton. You know, yeah. If he's willing to do that to Ric Flair after what he's done for the industry and da-da-da, you can spin it. So, really, really good stuff. That leads us, we've got one more week till SummerSlam. So we'll be back next Tuesday talking about, the Go Home Raw. And This Friday, SmackDown, we'll know kind of where the land lies with everything. And as always, I'm sure there'll be more news because there always is.
As always. Can I just mention one more thing from Raw?
Sure. Okay.
At one point, Retribution were outside and they turned a car on its roof.
They're so hard, aren't they? They're just... Jesus Christ.
I mean, how did they do that?
They're so bad. But I kind of get a kick out of the back. I hope that they start doing things that are like crapper every week. So by because remember, do you remember in the Riot Squad where like all but a riot and they would like throw paper cups around the back?
Knocked a bin over, I think, one time.
They knocked an empty bin over. What a riot!
Next thing, they'll be scooping up some dog do, put it in newspaper and setting fire to it, won't it, on someone's doorstep.
I think we're 3 weeks away from it, Finn. I think we're on route to that scenario. That's it for us here in the main podcast. Finn, have you got any plugs for us? Any plugs where can people check out your ebooks if they want to find out more about the PowerSlam years or your interview books?
Oh, yeah, they're available on Amazon, as people know. Yep, Pressing Through the PowerSlam Years, PowerSlam Interviews 1 and 2. So, yeah, please check those out. Actually, they've been doing, ever since they've, there was VAT on ebooks, but there isn't anymore. And they've actually been doing, I don't know whether this has got anything to do with it, probably hasn't, but it certainly has something to do with my earnings from those books. So they've been selling better than they were, or at least I've been doing better out of them than I was prior to that change to the VAT law. So
fantastic.
Yeah, they're still out there, still available, hopefully still relevant. So check them out. How about yourself, Kenny?
The usual plugs, as always. You can go to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/InsideTheRopes. Over 166,000 subscribers. We hope you'll go over there and join us. Interview clips going up there all the time. Clip just went up with Chris Jericho. Stuff from last week with Tama Tonga from the Bullet Club. So stuff going up there all the time. And then also Patreon. Patreon.com/InsideTheRopes, where you can get bonus content this a day early. We always do an overrun every week. Finn does bonus articles over there as well. Sandra and I do retro ITR. We look back at WWF, WWE 20 years ago. Finn comes in for the pay-per-views every month. We're doing SummerSlam 2000 in a couple of weeks.
Yes.
So, yeah, lots of stuff up there. We hope that you'll check us out and give us some support during this time. We really appreciate it. So, yeah, that's pretty much it for us. Finn, get out there in the sunshine this week at some point. Have a beer on me.
I'm going to do that, Kenny. I'm going to have a drink on you.
Well, have a drink for me, not on me. I'm not paying for the drink, but I will. I'm there in spirit.
That was too good to be true, wasn't it?
Although I will remove that stipulation. If you want a Jaeger bomb, send me the Witherspoon's table number and I'll have a round to your table in 3 minutes.
But thanks, but no thanks.
Well, ungrateful bastard. Anyway, thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We hope that you have a great week, whatever you're getting up to, and we'll talk to you soon. If I be tonight, if I'm sad tonight.